commencing countdown. T minus 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Ignition.
What an incredible smell, you scum!
Dear Lord Jesus, this ain't happening, man. This can't be happening, man. This ain't happening.
Inconceivable!
Autobots, transform!
Welcome to the third episode of the Skiffy and Fanny Show, guys. I'm Sean.
And I am Adam.
Are you gonna say our tagline, Adam?
Oh, okay, I'll say our tagline. Our tagline this week, two sci-fi geeks and a pie.
Sounds very tasty. And kind of creepy.
Well, unless your pie's filled with an infinite number sequence. Then you get full really fast.
This is true. But that sounds a little rich to me. Anyway, we're not going to talk about pie today. That is not.
That honestly made no sense. I have no idea why we just said that.
No, I don't either. You're crazy. Moving on to our intro discussion of the week, which is a list by Crawford Killian called "The 10 Most Harmful Novels for Aspiring Writers." Anybody who knows Crawford Killian probably remembers him as a science fiction writer. I do because I've read his books. He wrote the Empire of Time novels, which are actually pretty good. And he hasn't published anything recently. I think he's retired now. But stuff that's on the list are pretty interesting. There's some big names like Ernest Hemingway, Jack Kerouac, Ayn Rand. Cormac McCarthy's on the list. J.R.R. Tolkien is on the list. And J.D. Salinger and some others that I've never heard of. I thought it was a really interesting list. And I think we should talk about who we think are some of the novels and perhaps novelists who are harmful for aspiring writers. So I'm going to let you go, Adam, because I'm sure you've got a good one to start with.
Okay, well, I was thinking, and I think that Fight Club by Chuck Palahniuk still is a harmful novel because he kind of if you've read that novel, you know exactly why it's harmful. It's edgy, quotations. It's stylistically different from what was being published, although if you read, it's not really all that original. It had the whole, you know, twist ending type. It was just, after that came out, you saw just a flood of novels like that come out, and still if you read it, I know I've met a bunch of people who that is the reason why they started writing, and that is exactly how they sound when I read their stuff. They sound exactly like Fight Club ripoffs.
I've only seen the movie for Fight Club, and I was not impressed.
And the book's not even that good.
I know somebody who would vehemently disagree with you, but...
Oh, I know a lot of people who would. The book, actually, I think it was chapter 6 of the book, was originally a short story that he shopped around for a long time without actually getting it published, and after it got published once, he reused that short story and lived off of it for an entire year. I think the anecdote goes. And then if you read the book all the way through, you can see that chapter that is a short story is way stronger than the rest of the book. It's chapter 6 or 7, I'm pretty sure.
I haven't read the book, but I'm sure some of our listeners have, and maybe they'll send their hate mail to you for mentioning.
Oh, they will. He's one of those cult writer guys that could get me death threats, and I don't really care because I don't like him. I think his novels are derivative, and they're like the Tarantino of the book world.
But I like Tarantino.
I don't.
Well, but you don't like vulgar movies, and his movies are really, really vulgar.
No, I just think they're all show, no substance.
You even think that of Pulp Fiction?
Yeah.
There's something wrong with you. You've got... Ugh.
I'm hypercritical of movies, too, so...
I'm hypercritical of movies, too, but as well. But Pulp Fiction's a classic, man.
By your definition, possibly not mine.
By the world's definition. One of the best movies ever made.
Okay, that's a little far.
It is. It's in the top 50.
But this comes from the person who didn't like 2001: A Space Odyssey.
I found Space Odyssey boring.
So what does your opinion really matter?
My opinion matters very much.
We'll let the fans decide.
Well, so far they're not even listening to your little challenge about the Skiffy and Fanny nonsense, so...
I think that's just because it's so obvious that they don't feel the need to.
You just keep telling yourself that. You're deluding yourself, but, you know, it makes you feel better inside. Moving on now, I would actually put on this list, probably the most obvious example would be Stephanie Meyer, who we all know wrote Twilight and Eclipse and whatever the other novels are, the eight of them or whatever there are now.
Four.
I'm going to say eight, because it feels like eight.
The ones you missed were New Moon and Breaking Dawn, and then she wrote a science fiction book called The Host.
Yes, The Host, and I'm told The Host is the best of her books, but...
And sometimes I'll just open up a book and start reading from the middle, because then you can really tell if the book is decent or not, if a page in the middle grabs your attention. Oof, there's not enough, there's not enough time in this podcast for me there's enough people doing this right now, so... We don't need to.
Yeah. Well, Myers, just I run a website for young writers, and we get, I don't know, maybe every month at least five or six people join specifically to write a vampire novel that sounds suspiciously just like Twilight. And we get these kids all the time. They usually can barely string together a sentence because they talk in text speak, which is an abomination of language and should be culled completely. In fact, people who use it should be re-educated for the sake of mankind. But that's a different argument. So you get all of these people writing vampire novels, and we've seen the influence, too, in young adult literature, which is vampire novels everywhere. Every time I go to Walmart and I look at the little book section, all I see are vampire novels in the little like YA section. That's like all that they sell now. There's nothing else. So she's definitely one of those that I think is pretty poor.
You took the easy way out.
I did take the easy way out, but so be it. You can deal with it. She's horrible. Who else would you put on this list?
Who else do I think is harmful to the genre? Different discussion.
Yes, yeah. Well, Myers would be on that list, too, I would think.
Oh, she'd be the ringleader of it. harmful? I actually, you know, because harmful is a strange word. I could, you know, a lot of really great writers are the harmful ones. Like, China Mieville, because his style is so him. Mm. No one else can write like him, but I bet you a lot of people try to write like him and completely get it wrong. I think we might be able to put him on the list. Just but any writer who has a very distinct personal style, who becomes any way popular, either best-sellingly like Meyer or just like a cult hit, they could be considered harmful.
I don't know if you could put Mieville on there, just because I don't know what his influence is yet. He's potential. He could be a potential bad influence for her.
Yeah, that's what a potential. As soon as, you know, Perdido Street Station becomes a classic or whatever.
Yeah. I mean, Myers, at this point, her influence is painfully obvious. Whereas I don't know if that's quite the case with Mieville. I mean, maybe within British literature that's true. I don't know. I haven't read enough British novels to know, but yeah. I would also put and you disagreed with me earlier today, I'm gonna put most of the Golden Age science fiction and fantasy authors.
No.
Yeah.
No one writes in a Golden Age style anymore.
No, but people constantly read them and are influenced by them.
But that's not a bad thing, because they bring the adventure sensibilities of the Golden Age to the literary sensibilities of now.
No. See, because you get a lot of people who do read them and do try to write like some of them.
I have never read anyone who could even come close to a Golden Age author in style. It's just a different time period. It's hard to write like it.
That doesn't mean that they... I don't mean that they write like them, but people who who are influenced by them, who take after them, I think in a lot of cases that's a bad thing. I think they have the potential to harm a lot of aspiring writers who don't read some of the new stuff to see where prose has gone now, or to see where plot styles have gone. Because a lot of Golden Age stuff, I mean, was written, like, for example, Childhood's End by Clark was a serialized novel in parts, and he wrote the parts separately. And the same with some of Asimov's stuff. And the way that the plots work in those, that's almost not acceptable today. You can't really do that.
I think you're talking about it. If you're over influenced by anyone, that's a harmful writer. But if you're are influenced by someone, you can't say every influence is harmful.
Well, no, that's true. But I do think that Golden Age authors have a tendency to harm aspiring writers.
Pretty much every science fiction writer was inspired by Golden Age writers.
Yes.
Or New Wave writers. And I think the New Wave is far more harmful than the Golden Age, because people still write in a New Wave style.
Okay, all right. I will concede defeat on that then. Fine.
Owned.
Oh, I'm not really. I completely disagree, but I don't want to push the matter too much further.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I do agree, though, on the list that Cormac McCarthy, he gets mentioned for Blood Meridian, but I do think that his novel, The Road, is harmful, or at least potentially harmful.
Oh, no, it is harmful.
Because it really is, like, it's completely derivative, and it gets hailed as this wonderful post-apocalyptic, you know, piece of fiction. But, and this is an article, I saw an article that said just this, but people who talk about this novel conveniently ignore the massive history of post-apocalyptic fiction that preceded it, and don't talk about, because if you talk within that context, the novel is literally meaningless, because it's just like a copy of so many novels that precede it. So, and I think people who do try to emulate that, who take him to heart, and don't try to get a handle on maybe the genre that they want to write in or whatever, that's harmful to their writing. And you get novels like this that don't pay attention to what came before, that just sort of ignore it, and we end up with repeats. This is the reason why I like John Scalzi, because he wrote Old Man's War, which is kind of a tribute to sort of all of these old Golden Age writers, but he sort of took those ideas and then went in his own direction with it. And I thought that was what really worked, because he was familiar with that stuff that preceded him and knew that things he could play with and make maybe more hilarious or whatever.
I think there's two different categories of harmful writers. There's harmful in style and harmful in content. Myers is harmful in content, and Cormac McCarthy is... Well, somewhat, but you can't really say she has a style except for, you know, like, eighth grade level writing.
Exactly.
And Cormac McCarthy, he is mostly harmful for his style, which is a very stark, brutal style.
Yeah.
But, you know, you can't have too many people writing that way, because it's actually a really simple way to write.
Yeah, I did think that The Road was... I didn't understand what was so quote-unquote literary about it, because it really does read like any sort of mainstream popular sort of thriller book, kind of, except for that it's not a thriller, obviously. But
well, it's just, if you put this in the literary circles, it's the highest. If you, you know, like, put it against the backdrop of our genre, it's not even a mid-lister. It's, you know, it's not that good compared to other post-apocalyptic books.
Oh, no, when you compare it to post-apocalyptic literature as a whole, it's pretty mediocre.
Yeah.
I don't even think it's that good in literary circles. I didn't understand why The Road got the Pulitzer. I enjoyed the novel when I read it. I thought it was fun.
The Road was fun?
Fun in a reading way, because I did enjoy the process of reading it. But
I didn't hate it.
You didn't hate it, which means you didn't like it either.
Well, I love post-apocalyptic literature. I love dystopian literature. I love all, you know, the dark future.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I was comparing it to all these other books. And yeah, the relationship between the boy and the dad is, or and the man, whatever, that is why most people enjoy that. And that was just not enough to keep me reading.
I didn't even think the relationship was very well done.
I didn't think so either, but that, honestly, there's a bunch of, like, everyone clings to a facet of the road, and that's what they like about it, whether it be McCarthy's style, the relationship, the fact that it's post-apocalyptic, and most literary people don't read that.
Yeah.
Everyone clings to it, you know, as something being unique, but when you put it together, nothing in that book is original.
No, it's very much like Stephanie Myers, not all that original, because Myers is really, when you look at Myers,
that's a little much.
No.
McCarthy, he does have a clear style, at least, and it's very readable in how simple it is. He doesn't use flashy language or metaphors, or he just puts it out there, which to some people think is a great literary breakthrough, but I think it's kind of boring.
And he doesn't have any sparkling vampires.
That could have made the road a little better.
You think sparkling vampires could have made it better?
I think sparkling vampires can make the world better.
Oh God, I just lost all faith in you.
I know.
Yeah.
I'm kidding.
Yeah. Well, do we have any others? I can't think of any others easy to pick on that I know are really good choices here.
Well, I haven't seen a lot of, you know, like in the real genre community, I haven't seen many derivative works lately.
Well, I mean, if you read any fantasy, it's pretty easy to find.
But I don't read much fantasy. The fantasy I do read is very not your typical fantasy. The most traditional fantasy I'm reading right now is Adrian Tchaikovsky's, and I think that is rather innovative.
Yeah, I haven't read those yet, but I've heard they're good.
They're good. Yep. I mean, if you want to read fantasy and you want it to be exciting, it's very it crosses a lot of genres within it. And it's really cool. It's a very cool book. You know, like, oh, that's a great idea.
Okay. Well, I may have to read that then. But I haven't had the chance yet. In fact, I don't own it yet. I need to get that. But I've heard they're very, very good, so, and I trust your opinion, particularly after the whole ordeal with Spar last week. So, generally speaking, I trust your opinion on many things. When you recommend a book to me, I know it's probably going to be pretty good.
Yeah, it is.
So, I mean, beyond this, beyond that stuff we've mentioned and the stuff that's on the list, like Tolkien, I think there's probably an obvious example for fantasy writers, just because of his influence.
Oh, probably Gibson on the science fiction side was a harmful writer.
Yeah,
especially now, because if you write traditional Gibsonian cyberpunk now, you're going to be laughed at. You have to do something. You have to do either post cyberpunk or just take it another direction. You cannot write Gibsonian cyberpunk right now.
Well, unless you're in Eastern Europe, in which case it's perfectly acceptable.
Yeah, I read that.
Huge there.
That's because they're just getting the internet.
No, they've had the internet for a while.
I know, but it's more than just message boards and chat clients.
It's Europe. It's not like, you know, sub-Saharan Africa.
Google's in Romania now.
Yeah?
I don't know.
they've had the internet there for a very long time.
I know, because they've been putting in the fiber optics. That's what they do. That's their working.
Well, okay,
that's
then.
Their working. And that's my Eastern European dialect. That's their working. I don't really know what I'm saying. I'm kind of tired today.
But going back to the Gibson point, I do agree that after Gibson and sort of the people that immediately followed him or were in that same time period, going back to that sort of cyberpunk really... You just can't. You can't do that without immediately being compared. And once you're compared to Gibson, it's really, unless you've written something so amazing, the comparison's not going to be a good one. It'll be a negative. So,
well, maybe there's a Gibson for the Web 2.0 stage.
Well, I would think that would have maybe possibly some Robert J. Sawyer.
The WWW. W. Wake?
Yeah, Wake and Watch, and the third one, whose title I forgot, but
they have cool covers. I dig those covers.
Yeah, I do like the covers. And those books are supposed to be good. Unfortunately, his series Flash Forward was canceled after the first season. So
that's an interesting idea. I do think Robert J. Sawyer's the science fiction fan's Crichton. Just kind of a funny thing to say, but that's what I think. Like, if you're into science fiction, it's the action, you know, it's the action pop science fiction genre.
Action pop science fiction genre?
Yes, action pop sci-fi genre.
I guess, is that like a new subgenre? Are we inventing that now?
No, that's like all the thrillers that rely more on science fiction than your traditional thriller.
So, I mean, you wouldn't put the Bourne books in there?
Obliquely, maybe, but they're not really science fiction-y.
Yes, they are.
I mean, James Bond would almost be in the pop sci genre just because of the near future gadgets he uses.
I think James Bond is a science fiction character.
But I would put him in the Crichton area. Sawyer has a lot more science, and his science is a lot better than Crichton science.
Yeah, well, you know, we can, of course, make dinosaurs out of mosquitoes, cotton amber, and frog DNA, and ostrich eggs.
He's a much more clever, much more literary, even though it's not. He's a better writer, and he's more clever than Crichton. Who is a harmful writer? Ha. Huh? Harmful writer, if you're starting out.
Why would you say Michael Crichton's a harmful writer?
Because, well, if you write Crichton like Crichton, you'll probably sell it. But it's just, you know, on you know, your site, there's a lot of people whose favorite science fiction writer is Michael Crichton, and that's why it's a harmful writer.
I don't know.
He's not like a gateway drug into science fiction. He's a gateway drug into thrillers, you know?
Yeah, and I think, well, most of his science is pretty suspect.
Oh, it's might as well be fantasy.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty out there. I mean, he did what did he do with, like, the climate change one?
He did one with
climate change, but, like, it was something, it was very clearly, like, right-leaning anti-climate change book, but when you read it, when I saw people who were talking about the science in it, they were pointing out that his science was really off, you know. But, I mean, why should we be surprised? He was a doctor, not a physicist.
I mean, so if you want to be a science fiction writer and Michael Crichton's the guy you want to emulate, then that's why. Then it would be harmful for you. I mean, all these books are harmful in certain circumstances.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Okay, so
Well, why don't we'll go to the music real quick, and then we'll come back for some news, which we've got some cool stuff in the news. So we'll be right back.
And we're back with some more news. First on the agenda is Will Smith, as Sean put, is the science fiction god.
Yeah.
Independence Day 2 and 3 are rumored, along with a saucer load of other Smith sequels and prequels. Yeah, like Men in Black 3, Hancock 2, iRobot 2, the prequel to I Am Legend, Monster Hunter, Flowers for Algernon, and Angelology.
Yeah, it's a huge sort of sci-fi fantasy mix this guy's doing. I mean, it's just crazy, because he's got like 20 projects that he's quote-unquote in development for, and like half of them are sort of genre-related, so he really is like our science fiction god, because the guy is just doing everything.
And, you know, his movies are almost always fun, his science fiction movies, even if they're not true to, you know, the source material, and they're a bit goofy, they're usually fun.
Well, like Men in Black, I love the Men in Black ones. It's really good. I really loved Independence Day.
Oh, yeah. Independence Day was one of the big things that got me into science fiction when I was little.
It's a good movie. It's really well done. He's got a great character in it. I don't know what they're going to do for iRobot 2, but...
I don't know what they're going to do with the prequel to I Am Legend, more quotes, unquotes.
Well, it's supposed to take place to explain how the infection got to where it is. But I mean, there's not a whole lot you can do with that to make it interesting. I find prequels annoying.
It's going to be apocalyptic instead of post-apocalyptic.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah.
But honestly, they really should drop the I Am Legend, because only probably about 5% of I Am Legend had anything to do with the book.
Yeah, the name of the character, the fact that there was a disease.
The fact that he's alone.
Yeah, the fact that he's alone in a city.
There's a dog in it somewhere.
Hey, the relationship with the dog was very sad.
In I Am Legend, the book, that relationship was, you know, 1,000 times better than the boy and the man in the road. I mean, that was heart-wrenching. Mm. But, and then there's, you know, the fact that there is a zombie that's, or vampire, what are they in the movie I Am Legend?
They're like a mix, like vampire-zombie.
Well, the vampires in the book, you know.
Oh, in the book. Yeah, they're different in the book because they talk.
Yeah, well, not all of them, only Ben.
Well, I haven't read the book, so excuse me.
You go read it now.
I don't have time to read it right now.
Now, right, leave. I'll take care of the rest of the podcast. Richard Matheson is the only guy to be both a grandmaster of horror and science fiction.
He's got both?
Yeah.
That's impressive.
Yeah, and his writing is amazing.
Well, I've heard he's good, so I have the book. I will read it. Chill out.
I can't chill out. This is a travesty.
It's not a travesty. Anyway, get back to Will Smith. He's doing a lot of big stuff. It's nice to see that they're doing Flowers for Algernon.
Yeah, it's kind of a weird role for Will Smith, I think, though.
A little bit, but I think he can pull it off. He's got acting chops for sure.
Isn't Monster Hunter a video game?
I think so. I put it on there because I think it's a genre one, but I wasn't 100% sure because there's no information.
I'm pretty sure I've seen like trailers and stuff for the video game, and all that happens is you go and kill gigantic dragon-esque beasts.
Oh, well, I'm sure there'll be a plot in the movie.
I don't care if there's a plot if it just keeps that. There's just huge fight scenes where Will Smith, you know, has a 20-foot gun and is shooting dragon-esque beasts. I'd pay $11 for that.
I'll pay matinee, but I'm not going to pay $11. I rarely pay full price for movies anymore.
And then isn't Angelology a YA book?
Yeah, it's a book that just came out fairly recently, last year, I think. So it seems like they're already pushing it, which is pretty impressive. So
yeah, I have a series in the works called The Philosophology. Do you think Will Smith can come on board for that one?
No, he's already done with an allology on the end, so.
Philosophology. I think that's how I spelt it. It just keeps saying wall, wall, and you'll get there.
Yeah. Well, also in news, it's sort of an old story that's now progressing because it's coming closer to publication. The cover art and synopsis for The Passage by Justin Cronin has been released, and this is big news. Not just because it's a cover art and synopsis, which sounds kind of dull and boring. It's big news because this guy was a very sort of unknown author before he got this deal, this trilogy deal, in which he was paid $3.75 million by Ballantine Books for a trilogy of novels. And his movie rights have already sold to 20th Century Fox and Ridley Scott's production team for $1.75 million. So... that's a lot. That's a huge chunk of change.
And it's just, you know, makes you wonder when you have so many reports in the news of publishing houses consolidating or cutting whole divisions, how Ballantine ponied up $4 million to a guy who I don't think has ever written genre before. And he's only written two novels previously. I mean, they're taking a huge risk on this.
Yeah, a huge risk.
I mean, $4 million for three books. They have to sell a lot. They have to move, you know, a couple million copies to recuperate that.
Yeah, and it seems like they're going to be pushing really hard on this. You know, I mean, this really dwarfs like when Alistair Reynolds got that $1 million publishing deal.
For 10 books over 10 years. Plus, he gave up international rights, too. That $1 million encompassed a lot of different things. It wasn't a traditional just four books. You know, he gave up. He might have even given up, you know, the film rights to it, too. I can't remember.
He might have. I don't know.
But I don't understand how, you know, this guy has made $5.5 million off of two books and a movie deal. And he sold the movie deal without even the first book being done.
Right, right. That's insane.
I need to find the name of his agent.
Well,
I really do.
Very, very good if they managed to sell an unfinished book to Ballantyne. They didn't have the first bit. I need to learn how to speak again. He didn't even have the first book finished when he sold it to Ballantyne.
How do you even get an agent without having a book finished? Well, he had those other two books, but how do you sell that?
It's not just that. It's sort of an issue, like, if he had been published by his previous publishers for his two books, they could have sold the book before it was finished, but he's switching publishers to a genre publisher, and he's never written genre before, or for this publisher, so the fact that they took it before it was finished is really unusual, because that happens all the time. Like, if you have a relationship with a publisher, say you write three books, and then you propose to your editor, I want to write blah, they will take that.
But there's got to be some sort of extenuating circumstance for this to happen. I cannot just see this. I mean, otherwise this book will have to be, you know, the greatest book written in this century to warrant that kind of money.
Well, early reviews say it's pretty good because the Wart Zone had a chance to review it. They got an advanced copy in April, I think, and said it was pretty good.
Pretty good is not worth $4 million.
I don't know. Maybe not for you. Maybe for Ballantyne. I mean, to be fair, I mean, I think some publishers would willingly give $4 million if they could get Harry Potter and Twilight. So, because the amount of money those both have pulled in is massive.
This does not. I mean, the synopsis doesn't even sound remotely interesting.
Right, right, right. The synopsis is, Amy Harper Belafonte is 6 years old and her mother thinks she's the most important person in the whole world. She is. Anthony Carter doesn't think he could ever be in a worse place than death row. He's wrong. FBI agent Brad Volgas thinks something beyond imagination is coming. It is. The Passage. And that doesn't really tell you what it's about, but roughly speaking, it's set in 2017, so it is semi-science fictional. And it involves something to do with Amy, who is some sort of link to discovering immortality. But when the government comes and gets her and perform the tests go horribly wrong, and some sort of thing gets released into the world. Beyond that, I don't know.
This kind of sounds like a Michael Crichton book.
Well, to be fair, Michael Crichton's a best-selling author, so I'm sure it would sell.
Ugh. Even if it sells as good as Crichton, they're not going to make their money back.
No, not on the first book, but maybe on three, they might make it back.
It's just so...
But I wonder who sold the movie rights, because if he had his movie rights before he went with Ballantyne, that means it's an additional money he made. If he sold the rights to Ballantyne, because I'm not sure what he sold, then they already made 1.75 out of it.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I'm not sure. I'm not sure what he sold.
It doesn't matter. It's wrong.
Well, I would imagine for $3.75 million, he probably sold a lot of rights away.
There's not a book I can imagine that's worth that much.
Really? Not a book you can imagine?
No, my favorite book isn't worth $4 million.
You're crazy. I'll write something that's worth $4 million. You wait.
Mm-hmm.
And it'll be rejected like a dozen and a half times, I'm sure. Which brings us to our last segment.
Good segue, Sean.
Yes, I did that in purpose. I'm very intelligent.
You did that in purpose?
On purpose. I meant segment.
What were you in?
I was in a movie once.
Oh. That doesn't answer my question.
No, it doesn't. Anyway, we move on to the funny rejections. thing. The Examiner listed 30 famous authors whose works were rejected. Some of these folks we've probably all heard of. 8 are for sure science fiction or fantasy authors on the list, and there are some in between, but we won't really talk about them. And the rejections are actually either really, really mean or just hilarious. Like, Stephen King's Carrie, you know, Carrie, like the pig's blood Carrie, you know, was rejected because we are not interested in science fiction which deals with negative utopias. They do not sell.
Yeah, but, you know, it was only rejected a dozen times, you know, but dozens of times or a dozen times?
I think it was a couple dozen times, but I could be wrong.
That's not too many. But that rejection letter is very strange. I wonder who he sent it to get that.
Well, it doesn't say on the Examiner thing, but, I mean, this is not unusual within the big publishing houses. They send funny rejections and dumb rejections all the time. Like, George Orwell, who is probably one of the most important authors in the 20th century, his Animal Farm, which is a classic, was rejected because they didn't think they could sell animal stories in the U.S., which I think has been sort of proven to be a load of BS, because not only did Animal Farm sell very well, we have Watership Down, we have the Brian Jacques books, enough YA novels involving animals
what
as
about
the main characters.
Winnie the Pooh.
Winnie the freaking Pooh, yeah, that's another one. To be fair, I mean, Animal Farm is an adult novel, but yeah.
Animal Farm is awesome.
It's a pretty good one. I saw the animated movie before I read the book, so.
Yeah, it's weird. At my library, that animated movie is in the kids section.
It's not even a kids movie. It's pretty dark.
It is. I think Animal Farm is far better than 1984, but that's just my opinion.
I think that's debatable. I prefer 1984 over Animal Farm, but that's me.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, and some other authors on the list, Ursula K. Le Guin, who actually got a like really mean, scathing rejection of The Left Hand of Darkness, which is considered now to be pretty much one of the classic science fiction novels ever. It's on like everybody's list. It was listed so many times last week when we talked about the mind melt. And her book was literally torn apart in the funniest rejection, because it starts very mean and then it ends on like a happy note in which she says thank you. But like he says, that the editor who rejected her said, "The book is so endlessly complicated by details of reference and information, the interim legends become so much of a nuisance despite their relevance, that the very action of the story seems to be to become hopelessly bogged down and the book eventually unreadable. The whole is so dry and airless, so lacking in pace, that whatever drama and excitement the novel might have had is entirely dissipated by what does seem, a great deal of the time, to be extraneous material. My thanks nonetheless for having thought of us, though. The manuscript of The Left Hand of Darkness is returned herewith." So he rips her to shreds at first, and then he says, "But thanks for sending it to me. That was very enjoyable, wonderful." Like,
see, that rejection letter to me is far better than a form rejection. That much. But then again, you know, that rejection letter probably would have, you know, influenced me to change, you know, my manuscript. Because I use rejection letters as tools to help my pieces get stronger. But if she would have changed it to what he wanted, there's no way The Left Hand of Darkness would be a classic, even though I haven't read it.
Yeah, you have to be really careful with rejections, I've learned. Because some people give you advice, but that advice may not be very good. Because no two publications are, usually they're not the same. And so what doesn't work in one place may work elsewhere. And if you start changing around stuff too much, then you end up with something that is unsellable to everybody. So
mm-hmm.
You can. I mean, sometimes you get really good advice. Like, I actually got a rejection from Analog once that told me to review format. And when I reviewed format, I realized I'd done a lot of things wrong. So I fixed it. But, yeah.
My favorite rejection was J.G. Ballard's Crash, though. That's a great one.
Yeah.
The author of the book is beyond psychiatric help. Honestly, though, if you read some of Ballard's stuff, you think that. Like the Atrocity Exhibition, Terminal Beach, all of those where he really started to experiment with form and, you know, like hard psychology, they are tough. And you just start to wonder if anything is meaningful at all or if he's just rambling.
Well, I mean, the same argument could be used for, like, Philip K. Dick. Some of his novels are really nuts, and the guy really probably was beyond psychiatric help, so yeah. That's a really fun... I laughed when I read that, because I just... It's just a very, very strange rejection.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously the most probably iconic of science fiction novels that everybody cites as the best... The sort of science fiction Lord of the Rings, I guess you would say, is Dune. We don't have an actual rejection, but we know for a fact that the novel was rejected by 20 publishers at the time before it was actually picked up by Chilton Books, who was at the time a small press known for – basically was unknown. And for what it was known to do, they had done auto repair manuals, and then they were publishing this, Dune.
Well – now they're not unknown. Now they're quite popular for their auto repair novels or manuals. That's what they publish. They publish anything that with an engine, they publish a repair manual for it. I worked at a library, so I know how many. And for all kinds of makes and models of cars. I mean, we honestly had probably 1,000 Chilton repair manuals. It was ridiculous.
So, I mean, they're still pretty much known for that and also for publishing
Dune. That's... awesome.
That's a great trade-off. We can do repair manuals and we get like the iconic sci-fi novel that everybody cites and has been turned into like 18 movies now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, at least, well, maybe two movies, and then they did a bunch of sequels for the other books, but so be it, whatever. So yeah, there's really just the funniest rejections, and the whole list, and we'll link to it in the show notes, but it includes other people who aren't really sci-fi authors, Borges and William Golding, who did Lord of the Flies.
Lord of the Flies could almost be science fiction.
It's kind of semi-fantastical in an odd way. Yeah, it has that sort of feel to it. That was actually rejected, by the way, for being an absurd and uninteresting fantasy, which was rubbish and dull.
I love the British rejection letters. They're so much better than American rejection letters.
They're so biting. They're just...
They just let you have it.
They just really want to make you feel like crap. Like, wow. I would laugh if I got that rejection letter, though. I don't think I would take that too seriously.
Oh, I'd frame that. I totally would frame it.
That would be really cool, yeah. So, I mean, beyond that, that's pretty much it for news this week, so... we're going to go to the music again, and we'll come back, and we've got a pretty interesting segment that will be very controversial, I think, when we're done, and we'll get much of your hate mail, so we'll be back in just a sec.
And we are back for a second time, and final time, actually, with our main discussion segment, which we always call our main discussion segment, but I have no idea if it's the longest segment on the show. And
sometimes
this is what Sean is tentatively titling Gender Fail.
I'm not tentatively titling it. I'm just putting it within the already big Gender Fail issue thing. It's just a part of it. It's not this particular moment isn't specifically Gender Fail. It's just part of a bigger thing.
And the background, so we can get into the discussion. How would you pronounce Paizo Publishing?
Yeah,
Paizo Publishing released an anthology that I thought sounded kind of interesting called Before They Were Giants, that put out like the first professionally published or just published stories of major science fiction and fantasy authors, and you had people like Joe Haldeman, Larry Niven, Ben Bova. More modern guys like China Mieville and did I have like Swanick or Resnick, one of the mics
Swanwick
on there?
Swanwick was there, Charlie Strauss.
Strauss, yes.
And, oh, who is the other guy that's on the... Oh, well, somebody else is on there, but it's a lot of big names. Most of them are pretty much big names, yeah.
But there's only one woman who I've actually never heard of, Nicola Griffith.
Yeah, I don't even know who that is. So.
And what I cannot remember what blog this was on that we took most of this off of. Do you remember the name of the blog?
I think it's something I can't even pronounce. Well, the blog that the that you can find out about the anthology is Flogging Babble, which is Swanwick's blog.
Mm-hmm.
And the other blog was called Girly Jones.
But the one with all the comments.
That would be the Flogging Babble.
Flogging Babble. And so that's our source material, what we're going off of. And, you know, because there's only one woman in the book, you know, a lot of people have kind of had fits about it. Mm-hmm. And we're to the point of being, like, just downright rude. And the editor came onto Flogging Babble and commented very, you know, succinctly, it was very straightforward, very succinct, and somewhat apologetic, but not really, just like, this is how it was, about why there's only one woman in the book. And his reasoning was that he himself made a long list of the authors he loved, and a lot of them were women authors, and then he cut out all the ones that were in previous anthologies like this. Like, Daw put out three of them, I think. Was it Daw back in the 90s? And there have been these first, you know, stories of the big hitters anthologies. So he cut out all of those, and then he started asking around to the people, can I publish your first story? And all but one woman said yes, and that's why there is only one woman in it, whereas a lot of the, you know, there's inevitably probably more guys on that list because, you know, a lot of the class, there's more, you know, quote-unquote giants in the field who are male and female. It's just, you know, a numbers game. But so after all the women turned him down, he only had one woman left. And I'm like, oh, that is a very, you know, straightforward, acceptable answer to why there's only one woman in this anthology versus, you know, like the Times going, oh, this is a blind read, we didn't, you know, or the other ones which were supposed to be just because it happened that way. Was their excuses? This guy had real, legitimate reasons why there's only one woman. And people were still mean to him. They were even meaner, in fact, after he posted this one. And he kept, you know, he's kept on trying to, you know, just calm him down and be like, why, this is the reason why. But some people are accepting the answer and having caveats. Some people are just, you know, totally throwing this guy under the bus.
Yeah, yeah. It's got pretty ridiculous because when you read the comments section... It starts out where it's sort of Michael Swanwick comes out and he talks about it, and then there's Farrah Mendelson who's a critic and I think an author, but mostly a critic, and all of these other people who just ripping him, and then he comes out and explains, and what you get is a couple of people who actually paid attention to what he said, and then Farrah Mendelson completely ignores over and over and over his repeats of exactly how he came up with the stories. She completely ignores the fact that he actually says, I went out and tried to get female authors, and I was turned down by a number of them for legitimate reasons. Some of them had already done something like this before. Some of them just didn't want to, maybe because that story had been republished like 10 dozen times. You know, there were good reasons. And so he only had one female author. But she completely ignores that he said he went to them. And so it's this whole big thing about how he eventually has to start apologizing in public, which I don't think he should have done, because I don't think he did anything wrong in this case. And nobody will listen to him. And they're just firing off their mouths and not listening to what he's telling them. They're just it infuriated me because, you know, if this was like the case of a guy who really did come out and like, I just hate women, you know, or whatever, or like he just literally said, I didn't even think of women authors, I can understand being a little bit upset about that because there are a lot of big name female authors, but he did. He approached many and he cut many off his list because they appeared in the other anthologies. And by the way, those other anthologies mentioned, somebody did the numbers and 24 major female authors appear in those anthologies that are similar to this one. So, I mean, it's not like he had a big number of people he could have picked from. Of those 24, I mean, that would have included Le Guin. That probably would have included Bujold, maybe Tiptree, you know, these other major authors, Butler, and so on. The whole problem for me is just the way that they reacted to this, because nobody immediately went to the publisher and asked, why are there no female authors in this? Nobody went to the Post and were like, well, how come there's no female authors? I mean, what about so-and-so? Some people did, but a number of people just immediately started throwing out the accusations that this is sexist, this is yada, yada, yada. Well, you know, sometimes that's legitimate. Those are legitimate criticisms, you know, because that does happen within genre fiction community. It happens a lot, unfortunately. But nobody went to the publisher and said, where are the female authors? Nobody maybe wrote to the publisher and said, this is a really cool idea. However, I would like to see a second volume have more female authors. You know, nobody really sort of went to the publisher and said, these are kind of the stuff I would like to see more of. What we got was, this is sexist. The editor is a sexist bastard.
All the people who published in it are sexist for not checking out that it was balanced first.
Yes, that was a comment that bugged the hell out of me too, because the responsibility of these authors to have gone through and checked to make sure there's a gender balance. Like, that's not their responsibility. They sold a story. You know, what are they supposed to do? Halfway through the production process go, I'm not going to work with you anymore? You know, no, you can't. You know, not to mention, none of these authors could have known exactly what the process was for selecting. I mean, how did they know? It's just, I find the whole thing just really irritating. Just, for me, you know, since we talked about last episode, we had the segment on genre inclusivity, and it's like, for me, this sort of angry, instant sort of knee-jerk reacting, it doesn't seem to me to do the genre community any good whatsoever. It seems like it actually damages it, because what we're getting is just people being really pissed off and angry, sometimes for good reason, sometimes not, and that for me can potentially damage careers. It doesn't really tell the publisher anything they want to know. You know, yeah, okay, you're pissed off, but a publisher doesn't care. What the publisher cares about is, well, are we going to make money? So, are they going to make money? They're probably still going to make money on this book. What they would, I think, would work better would be for people to sit down and go, well, hey, there aren't enough women. Let's all write to the publisher and tell them we want more women. If a publisher starts getting, like, loads of emails and letters and stuff that says, you know, we want more women, I would think a lot of publishers would listen, because women do make up a sizable portion of the book buying market. So, I don't know.
Yeah, but honestly, in almost all of the cases where this happens, because it happens a lot.
Mm-hmm. It's become more acceptable now with the internet that you can just...
I don't. Well, just, you know, with these anthologies that are not very diverse in, you know, with people of color or with women, I'm just so sick of this argument. I honestly am.
It's a legitimate argument, because there is not enough playtime for a lot of female writers and a lot of writers of color. To be fair to writers of color, it's not always obvious. As an editor, I edited an anthology, and short of me asking all my contributors what skin color they are, which I think is ethically wrong, you shouldn't ask people what skin color they are, that just sounds really fishy to me. We had, you know, a few people of color, but I had no idea. How was I supposed to know? And short of sort of iconic people of color, I mean, it's not easy for editors to know these things. So,
when I buy anthologies, and I buy a lot of anthologies, mm-hmm. I usually don't look to see the genre, the gender breakdown in the table of contents. I'm like, oh, that's a cool idea. I'm going to buy that. Or, oh, this is, you know, an anthology by one person. But most of the time I buy anthologies because they sound cool, not because of who is in them.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of do it because of who's in them, but only because I like to find anthologies that have more stories by people I like. So,
I like theme anthologies a lot. I look more for that, which is just because I'm into subgenres a lot.
Yeah.
So
I mean, it seems like both of us are pretty much just really tired of this sort of stuff.
Yeah, and out of all the, like, the gender fails, this is the silliest argument. I mean, the guy has a legitimate reason, and they're still ripping him apart.
Yeah, they're still ripping him apart. They forced the guy to publicly apologize, particularly because one of the comments he made was that he admitted that he probably he admitted that he didn't after he'd sort of gone down his list of writers that he liked that were female writers, he didn't go out and like learn new writers, which to me is to take him to task for that. I mean, I just don't feel like that's a good reason to take him to task. Like, okay, so he didn't go out and to find other writers, but I mean, he admits that what he did was he looked for the writers that he thought were most influential in the genre. He may be wrong, sure, but like, you know, like treating him like internet filth, like he's some sexist monster. I mean, that seems so counterproductive. Like, why didn't they just say, well, why don't you try these authors? And then if you do another anthology, you can maybe include them. Like, there's just, I just hate like that sort of just really angry rhetoric, this part of the community that just wants to scream and shout at every instance, and doesn't want to let up, even when they've either been proven wrong or it hasn't turned out the way they thought it originally was or whatever. You know, they just want to scream and yell and be angry. I understand why they're angry. I think more people need to step back, take a chill pill, and think about what they're saying, because this is just ridiculous.
Yeah. I mean, I'm probably going to buy Before They Were Giants just because they have a lot of authors I really dig, like Piers Anthony, William Gibson, Joe Haldeman, China Miéville, Larry Niven,
yeah.
Charles Strauss. These are all authors I really like. Plus, it comes with the authors giving commentary about how their stories, you know, came to be. And
right.
I love that sort of, you know, when you include little, you know, snippets from the author about their story, that just really adds a lot of value to the book, in my opinion.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah,
so it's probably going to be a really good anthology.
It probably will, but, you know, I feel very sorry for the editor. James Sutter is the editor, by the way. I just feel like he just got his ass handed to him for, pardon my French, but he did. For, honestly, he shouldn't have, and he should not have publicly apologized for anything. In fact, I think that other people, the people that just treated him like filth, even when it became clear that he wasn't, you know, I think they honestly should apologize to him for treating him that way, but you're not going to get that because that's just not the way it works, and it's total BS, but what are we going to do?
I mean, this would honestly be a really fun anthology to put together.
It would. It would be so exciting, and it would be really depressing if you, like, had a list, and you went down your list, and, like, some of them turned you down because you're like, I love those people.
Yeah.
You know?
So, just Aria, what do you people think? Do you think we're overreacting to the overreaction, or do you more agree?
Yeah, well, we'll put links in the show notes for this particular issue. I'm sure we're going to get hate mail for this. Maybe not.
Not much.
It probably won't. We're like unknown weirdos, so nobody will send us hate mail. But we would like to hear your reactions to this. If you could send us an email or a voicemail or whatever, we'll give that at the end of the show, or it's on the website. That would be great. But I think now what we should do is we should really, like, who are some of our favorite female science fiction fantasy authors? Ours, yeah.
You always ask me these questions and my mind blanks out. Of course I can say J.K. Rowling because I grew up with the Harry Potter books.
Okay, yeah.
And a lot more is just based on our piece-wise. Like, Kathleen Ann Gunin's Memory Dog was a really good story I read in last year's Dozois Best Of book. Nancy Kress has a story in Wastelands, edited by John Joseph Adams. That's
yes.
Really good. I can't remember the name of it. It was just, you know, a really deep, good story.
Mm-hmm.
I have a lot of them, but I'm not in front of my bookshelf right now, so.
Well, I mean, I would add to the list, like, some of my favorites are Elizabeth Baer, who does primarily science fiction. She does some fantasy, and her novels are fantastic. Cage Baker, who passed away earlier this year, unfortunately. Her novels are great. I like her fantasy more than I like her sci-fi, but her sci-fi is still very good. I just think her fantasy is a little deeper. That's my personal opinion. So I like them, and there are others, and I just totally drew a blank. I had a whole list in my head.
Oh, well, last year's best story, you know, in my humble opinion, that is completely correct. Sinner Baker Fabulist ... by Yuji Foster.
You know, okay,
she is obviously a woman, and that story was amazing.
Okay, okay. I haven't read that one yet. I definitely would not pick Kiz Johnson on this list, but that's based on having read Spar last week, so...
But most people actually probably would put Kiz Johnson on this list.
I'm sure she's written other stuff. Oh, somebody else I would add, who's probably not well-known as a science fiction writer, is Susan Beth Pfeffer, P-F-E-F-F-E-R. I can never pronounce her name right. She wrote this trilogy of post-apocalyptic books set on Earth in which that they're young adult and they're told through the journal entries of the main character. And they're really quite good. I loved each of them, all three of them. And I would definitely put it on the list, even though she's not only as she does a whole lot of other stuff too, but she's definitely there. And there are other authors whose names.
Oh, well, when I was little, Lois Lowry was one of the people I read a ton. She wrote The Giver.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Yeah.
I read a lot more female authors when I was younger than now. I don't know why that is. But, like, a lot of, like, when I was little, you know, like, my juvenile and YA reading were female authors for the most part. I just can't remember them now because I was little.
I don't remember. No, I read a lot of R.L. Stein when I was a kid.
Oh, me too. Still have, like, 20 Goosebumps books.
I sold them.
Those things were so great when I was little.
They're so terrible, though.
Now they are, but when I was little, they were it.
Final name that I just remembered, Octavia Butler. Yeah. Absolutely. Well, there's something wrong with you. If you don't like Octavia Butler, there's something wrong with you.
I would rather have there be something wrong with me than to say something that's untrue.
Well, then there's something wrong with you.
I need to make a concerted effort to read more female authors.
It would be nice, yes. Yeah. There are some great ones out there. I mean, try some Elizabeth Baer. Maybe try Cage Baker. Baer's novels, her sci-fi is really, really fantastic and fun. She likes to, like, test the boundaries. It's really neat.
Yeah. I think I'll do that this summer. I'll try to read more women authors.
Well, it'd be nice, you know, maybe you'll find some new ones that we haven't heard of. And there are a lot. I mean, if you read fantasy, I know you don't read as much, but I mean, anybody who reads fantasy, there are tons and tons of female authors who write adult fantasy and young adult fantasy. So, and there are some in science fiction, obviously. We've mentioned some, but there are others.
The Yellow Wallpaper by Charlotte Perkins Gilman, one of the greatest horror stories ever written.
Never even heard of that.
It's about a descent into insanity, and it's so good because I'm pretty sure Gilman actually was coming in and out of a psychosis.
I've never heard of it, but we'll have to definitely give it a shot then if I can find it.
Oh, it's in the public domain.
Oh, it's an old one then.
It's 1892.
Oh wow, that's pretty impressive.
But, like, when people say, try to list the women authors they really like, they always go to, like, Charlotte Bronte and all them people. And I've read them, and I think they're bunk.
Well, I think most stuff from a long time ago is bunk, but that's me.
So, yes, we would also like to hear your favorites, because then I would have a reading list for the summer.
Yeah, so who are your favorite female science fiction and fantasy writers, new and old, and why?
Or horror, too, you know, any genre, really, except for romance. Don't really care for that.
We're science fiction fantasy. We're doing that.
Horror is a good genre when it's done right.
Okay, fine.
And there's a lot of crossover. Horror, too. But
okay.
Not really crime or that. I don't want a bunch of Janet Ivanovich. So.
Okay, so yeah, if you guys could let us know, you can contact us either by email at skiffyandfanty@gmail.com. Voicemail at 206-337 8423. Somebody tried to send us a voicemail for last week's episode, and all we got was a click, so that was fun. I got to listen to a click, like, over and over for, like, a minute before I realized it was just one click. Or you can leave a comment on the post that this episode will be coming out in at skiffyandfanty.wordpress.com. And we keep forgetting to mention, but we're also on Twitter, in case you wanted to follow us on Twitter. We're, you know, twitter.com/skiffyandfanty, so you can follow us there.
That's and, A-N-D. And, you know, our final segment is our little reading and writing segment. So, Sean, what are you reading and or what are you writing?
Well, I just finished Angel Dust Apocalypse by Jeremy Robert Johnson, which was an interesting read. And now I'm moving on. I'm going to try to finish Blake Charlton's Spell Rites and Perdido Street Station. And I think I'm going to start reading the New Weird Anthology because I need to for the essay I'm working on.
I have that. But, like, I started reading, because, you know, it's an anthology you want to read straight through. And I found, like, the origins of the New Weird kind of strange because they're all mostly realist stories.
Yeah.
So that's why I didn't give it much of a shot.
Well, it's a weird genre. It sort of came out of a very weird process. I'm doing a lot of studying on it, so it's a strange place. And then in terms of writing, I'm still trying to finish this other Bizarro piece that I'm working on. And trying to get back into a story I started a while ago, which is actually a sequel to another story that I wrote. This story is called Atlas Awake. I'm not sure where it's going. All I know is the main character is a lesbian. So,
is there an exclamation point after awake?
No. There should be. Why?
Because that's like, Atlas Awake!
No, it's not that kind of story.
Dramatic,
it's post-apocalyptic sort of future stuff. Like, Earth is dead, but there are colonies. So, I don't know. It's...
So, exclamation point, trust me.
No exclamation points.
No, exclamation, not explanation.
No, I know. That's what I said. I said exclamation points.
No, you said explanation.
Well, I'm not going to explain myself to you anymore, mister. So, what are you reading and writing?
Reading, I picked up The Adamantine Palace by Stephen Dees to read over my vacation next week. Because I wanted to read, I really have not read any dragon-based fantasy. I've read fantasy with dragons in it, like, not much, though. I've read The Hobbit, which is pretty much the only dragon experience I have. And it looked, you know, sounded and looked pretty cool, so, you know, I picked that up. Oh, plus, he is an author who started publishing in the last 10 years. Going back to the segment last week, I do have one science fiction author who I enjoy who started publishing in the last 10 years, and that is Nick Harkaway, whose first novel, The Gone Away World, was just this cluster bomb of genre and awesomeness. And you could put it in science fiction, you could put it in fantasy, you could put it in Western, you could put it in horror. It's just an amazing book.
I wanted to read that. Is it in America now?
Oh, it's been in America for a long time. I have, like, they just released the mass market paperback, too, so.
Oh, okay, because, like, when I wanted to read it a while back, it was only available in the UK, so.
Oh, it's been in America since the beginning. I mean, the reason I picked it up was because it, you know, has this, like, nuclear pink and green cover that was fuzzy on the hardcover. It was actually textured, and it was, like, it was fuzzy. And so I looked online, and I found an ARC with the same colors of that, and got that for, you know, really cheap. But honestly, if you want to talk about an innovative book, you've got to read that book. It is amazing.
All right, well, it's on my list. All these books that you keep mentioning to me end up on my list, so. Yeah. And what about writing? What are you writing?
I haven't written anything original. I've probably up to over 40,000 words of editing. I've cut short stories to flash fiction. I've expanded flash fiction to short stories. I expanded a novelette. I've expanded a short story to a novelette, and I took a novelette down to a short story. So, I mean, I haven't written anything. I've, you know, written little synopses for new ideas as I do daily, but I didn't really focus on a short story. Probably today, though, because Wednesday I write a lot of short fiction. So
I get to go grocery shopping. Woo!
Nice.
Exciting. No, it's not. It's terrible. It's a boring hobby.
Hobby?
Yeah, it's a hobby. Grocery shopping is a hobby for me.
I understand that. I go grocery shopping enough for it to be a hobby, too.
Yeah, it's a hobby. Yeah, it's a necessity. It's a hobby. Ugh. Anyway, so that's basically our show this week. We really would like to hear from you guys. Email us, send us a voicemail, whatever.
Tell your friends.
Yes, tell your friends. And if you do leave a voicemail, make sure you don't just leave a click. Because we can't do much with a click. I'm not sure what that we're supposed to answer with that.
Okay. So we will talk to you next week.
All right, guys. Have a good one.
Goodbye.
Autobots, roll out!